Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Thanks very much, and it's really a privilege to introduce Charles tonight. And you know, this is the last presentation in a series of lectures that all of you, I imagine, are familiar with, and it's been a huge effort. I mean, in a way, I'm glad that we are ending this, but this is the beginning of an amazing amount of work, and I will get to that in a moment. But yes, welcome to this last presentation. And being the last presentation, there are an amazing amount of people that we would like to thank. So I will just read very quickly without naming names. In fact, if you're welcome to visit our website, where they will be some of these incredible people will be mentioned in more detail. UCSD by Design is a collaborative project of the UCSD Division of Arts and Humanities, the Campus Architect, the Stuart Collection, and the Museum of Contemporary Art San Diego. We would like to express our sincere thanks to many colleagues and supporters who contributed to the UCSD by Design project with financial, material, and of course intellectual support. Too numerous to name here, the many people involved came from across the campus, from offices of the Chancellor, Academic Affairs, Business Affairs, Campus Planning, the Scripps Institute of Oceanography, the Mandeville Special Collections Library, UCSD Extension, the communication staff, UCSD TV, faculty members from numerous academic departments, and many others, of course. We would also like to recognize the presenters from the first four events, who already have been mentioned by Catherine, Kurt Forster, John Walsh, Robert Storge, and Philippe Vassal, Gilles Clement. You can now see videos of these presentations on our project website at ucsdbydesign.ucsd.edu. We would like to acknowledge and thank the many moderated discussion participants. One thing that has been fantastic about this series is that not only we get an incredible figure here delivering a lecture, sharing ideas with us, but the following day, this discussion, the issues that have been opened up by this speaker are then continued and elaborated on in the campus as faculty and other members of the community and beyond come to debate some of those issues. And that has been a fantastic opportunity, which will linger, in fact, in years to come. But it has enabled the debate inside our campus, which is really the fundamental desire of this series. So many of these people who became part of this discussion. Finally, we would like to say a special thanks to Director Hugh Davies and his staff here at MCA for the enthusiastic and professional support as our partners in this effort. Most of all, of course, we would like to thank many of you who have been coming to all the series and the lectures, and some of you who are here for the first time. We are extremely grateful that you have been able to make this, and very much hope that you have found these events engaging and informative. You know, personally, if I can just mention, for me it has been an incredible experience, because you can imagine some of these, the organization of these efforts are unbelievable. I mean, it's been a year and before that since we began these discussions and before that. It's been a learning experience in a sense that the whole motivation of this project was not only to share with the public a variety of issues about in the celebration of this 50th anniversary of the campus through its architecture and art, but also it has been a way of enabling new knowledge that can, in fact, be projective in nature as we are now entering a new era. It's been amazing, at least for me, even though I work in architecture and urbanism, and some of us have not that much knowledge about how these environments develop. And it's been amazing to really go through a journey as the foundational moment of UCSD, as we called it in the process of discussing this, from the ocean to the mesa, as the foundational moment through Scripps began in the beginning of the 20th century, out of an incredible and engaged civic leadership and philanthropic leadership in this city, all the way to a series of planning projects that sort of oscillated between an aspiration towards density in the midst of suburbia in San Diego, but also at times try to recuperate this more, how would I call it, campus in the forest, you know, in the context of a more pastoral identity of UCSD. So in this back and forth pendulum of searching an identity, I think UCSD at this very moment is at a very amazing place to, in fact, begin to lead even more critically the question about sustainability. We all know that in the conditions of crisis, economic crisis that we find ourselves at this moment, the question once more is opened up, and how do we grow? At a moment, of course, when the way we have been growing in this region is unsustainable. So I think there is an amazing momentum at this occasion to begin discussing more critically these programs such as Sustainability 2.0 in campus are fundamental instruments to rethink the way campus operates across environmental, landscape, architectural, and urban issues. These are the conversations. I was saying it's a responsibility, not only for myself as a faculty member in UCSD, but also in terms of our community, how these conversations will be elaborated through our website and through the many actors really involved in these issues in the campus. Well, so that's the reason I think that after all these discussions that have been shared by thinkers to initiate this debate now, we end with Charles Jenks. I was lucky, in fact, to meet Charles a couple of times in London through Denise Bratton. And actually, you know, before I introduce Charles, just one more thing. I would like to say, again, it's been an amazing effort, but if there are two people that really deserve the most amazing sort of, recognition, is Heath Fox, who has led within the Division of Arts and Humanities this amazing effort. I'm talking about the day-to-day leadership, but also in terms of his conceptual resolution, together with Denise Bratton, a dear friend of mine, and I would like to acknowledge them, who truly have given shape to this program out of endless and most beautiful conversations throughout the last year and a half. So I was mentioning that I met Charles Jenks, not only, we're meeting the person that ultimately coined, you know, postmodern architecture, right? But I found also an amazing, incredible person who, in his critique of contemporary culture, in his poignant and acute critique of very current conditions, is a thinker that continues to develop and contribute, of course, to our own debate. What is also interesting is that Charles Jenks, while many people might recognize as a historian, a theorist, he is a practicing a landscape architect, and that for me is an incredible enabling kind of possibility. So Charles Jenks divides his time between lecturing, writing, and designing in the US, the UK, and Europe. He's the author of the best-selling The Language of Postmodern Architecture, reissued as a new paradigm in architecture in 2002. He has also written numerous other books on contemporary arts and building, including What is Postmodernism? And the Architecture of the Jumping Universe. His celebrated garden in Scotland is the subject of his book, The Garden of Cosmic Speculation. And in 2004, the Scottish National Gallery of Modern Art in Edinburgh won the Gulbenkian Prize for Museums for his design, Landform UEDA, UEDA. Landform projects have also been completed in Italy, France, and China. He's the author of The Iconic Building, The Power of Enigma, Critical Modernism, and The Architecture of Hope with Edwin Heathcote. Please join me in welcoming Charles Jenks.
Thank you very much for that, Teddy. I'm going to be speaking on many levels at once, comparing some of my own work to UCSD. I've been asked to speak on the coming of age of UCSD after 50 years and the possible flowering and maturity of the campus of some 50,000 people, more than half of whom are students. It's an intriguing topic with many attendant questions. They deserve a critical viewpoint, a critical modernism that challenges assumptions, or perhaps brings them to consciousness. Will your increasing densification result in a real and convivial urbanism, or will it mean overcrowding and crowding out nature, real oppositions? Will it mean facing up to the history of the past? The indigenous Indian population that is now almost 1% of this area, the Kumin-Ya people. You see here a little piece of wood marking a meandering trail which says, as carved in it, the oldest known archaeological site in Southern California, occupied by the Lahoyan One Indians. I guess Lahoyan One Indians is the first Lahoyan Indians, who've lived here on this site from 7,530 years ago to 190 years ago before the present site of UCLJ, that's UC La Jolla. And this was the site was discovered by radiocarbon dated in 1962. So there's that history, which is part of your history, part of the urbanism, in some yet to be fathomable way, and the history also of the military and defense industries that created San Diego and this campus, and the pluralism of styles and beliefs that bubble just underneath its surface, waiting for some kind of recognition. Will they be recognized? Will they find as much expression as the continuity has found? My strong feeling is that you at UCSD are entering the beginning of the middle of the end game of development, when the scale of planning has to change to a more convivial infill. The average size of building parcels here is about $70 million. When one thinks of that in historic terms, it's, of course, very big chunks of the environment created under late capitalism that create a very large building grain, whether one likes it or not, if that's the size of commissions varying from 20 to 180 million or even more. We have to obviously innovate with a more close-grained capitalism. These are some of the fascinating questions I will raise, but on my first visit here, having just arrived from London, I will not give more than suggestive and provocative answers. I've only been here 2 days, so what could I say of any depth? But I would like to thank several people in having given me this deep, quick education. Boone Hellman, the campus architect who has overseen some of this emergent work in the last 25 years, very intelligent plans. Heath Fox, who's been mentioned, who's helped me again and again. Brad Werdick, who did this morning, gave me a talk. Jamie Interval, who has taken us through the and around the campus and shown it as it exists rather than in a PowerPoint. And above all, Denise Bratton, who I've been conversing with on the telephone for the last month and through emails and in all sorts of ways. Denise is really behind so much of what I'm going to say tonight. I would like to say that therefore, all the mistakes in this talk are hers. But unfortunately, that's not the case. I have to claim credit. I will outline some strange strategies of my title, which is really called Realizing the Vision, From Cosmic to Contextual Counterpoint in Campus Design. And underline the kind of possibilities you have of creating both a cosmic and meaningful landscape, and an amusing contextual counterpoint, enjoying your differences, expressing them, allowing historical pluralism to come of age, along with your maturing campus. To paraphrase Victor Hugo's words in The Hunchback of Notre Dame, time is the architect, the place and the cosmos are the builders. I am arguing that there is already an inherent vision of UCSD that can be realized if it is brought to consciousness on another level and embraced the positive aspects of this vision. But before broaching these issues, let me acquaint you with some of my own writing and design, which addresses some of these points. I start with what has become the most visible movement in global architecture, loved and hated in equal measure, the emergence of the iconic building as a dominating force, if not one of the dominating movements. This recently revived trend stemmed ultimately in the postmodern period from Le Corbusier's symbolic and cosmic work at Chandigarh and in Rochon, the Rochon Chapel, which I illustrate. You can see the one of the views of the outside, and then some of the metaphors that others and I have found in this building, including the priests and so forth, praying hands, and the ship metaphor of Corbusier, a duck, what Robert Venturi called certain kind of buildings, duck buildings, then the cowl of, let's see if I can get, well, I can't get it, and then what the priest called the mother looking over her two children, looking at the morning and evening sun, as well as other metaphors. Now, Corbusier didn't mention metaphors when he designed this building. In fact, he only talked about the shell of a crab that was the inspiration for the roof. But as an iconic building, it really, as a temple to nature, which in a way it was, it opened up this whole tradition, which, of course, Frank Gehry, with his Bilbao Museum and the Bilbao Effect, has turned into this very strong movement. And one can see that in buildings such as the recently finishing CCTV building and hotel in the background by Rem Koolhaas, one of the aspects, the positive aspects of the iconic building is it's not only in a new language which relates to nature in certain levels, but uses multiple metaphors, including a Mobius strip, a Chinese puzzle, a kind of pop image, and then a chest of drawers and a skeleton of structure. In this case, the metaphor of a spider pulling all this network together, as well as pop images. So the iconic building, if you analyze both its virtues and vices, makes use of different metaphors which haven't been seen before and which are striking ones and which in the case of Rochon and CCTV have a certain relevance to the building task and the culture. So a good iconic building is one then that has multiple meaning and the meaning relates to the cause, to the context. I wrote a book on the iconic building in 2005, just at the point when it was being declared dead in Britain by the architects who hated it for understandable reasons that most iconic buildings are pretty bad and are anti-contextual and one-liners, cliches, etc. And I put this building on the cover by Norman Foster, and it's a large skyscraper which has the smallest ecological footprint and runs on vegetable oil, among other things. So it was an ecological building, had multiple meanings. And you can see the title, the subtitle, The Power of the Enigma. One of the things that makes a good icon is to be coherent in an enigmatic way, that is to suggest many things without naming them. So I used, in this case, a metaphor of a NASA rocket blasting off into outer space and underlined the cosmic meanings behind it. You can see I went through 9 covers, and one of the ones that I threw away was this, or at least the publisher threw away because the book was going to be sold under military hardware, was this rocket. And you even see then at the subtitle then was The Power of Paranoia. And it's very important to realize that in our culture, paranoia is a very important aspect of art and successful iconic buildings. If you think of the most famous iconic building perhaps ever designed and consciously designed as an icon, of course, it's the Eiffel Tower, 1889, for the exhibition, which, you know, was fought by the Parisians. It was 300 meters high, and they had the committee of 300 who tried to fight it every meter of the way. And their most damning attack on it was to say it was a form of Americanization. That was the ultimate insult in 1889. But Eiffel kept up his battle, built it. He was a capitalist. He funded it. He thought it was beautiful. No one else did. So for the next 2 or 3 years after it opened, it was the most sincerely hated building in Paris. You know the story. Another 10 years, it was accepted as a good place to see the city from. In 15 years, it became the symbol of Paris. In 20 years, the symbol of modernism. And, you know, in 25, 30 years, it became the symbol of all of France. It raises the question of the iconic building, is your building hated enough to become, successful, lasting icon? And I think it's a serious question, Wade, because paranoia in the art world and in contemporary culture is played with by artists who do not often design or paint or sculpt or install conscious metaphors, but slip around the public realm. And the analysis of some of the metaphors you see of this building are the military hardware, the rocket, the bomb, the bullet, the screw. This was after 9/11, so it was it entered a very paranoid time. Of course, what the British called it, the taxi drivers who gave it the nickname, they called it the Gherkin. You know, the little thing that you eat. It's not quite a cucumber. But they said that because in the land of Oscar Wilde, you can't call a spade a spade. So everybody knew what the gherkin was a symbol for, that male part, which is another reference of the building, and the brain and the finger. And the thing that it's most like, actually, is a pine cone and a pineapple, and it uses the Fibonacci series in certain ways. So multiple metaphor and an interesting relation to its site and to the ecological crisis. In the book, I analyze, in more recent iconic buildings, I analyze what I would call the hidden code, which is a code of nature. You see Ronchamp at the top there. You see the Bilbao below it. You see another of Rem's iconic buildings, Porto. Then those of Gehry, and so forth in this analysis, ending with the bird's nest, perhaps the most self-consciously designed iconic building by Herzog and de Meuron with the artist Ai Weiwei. And bird's nest soup in Hong Kong and China was the most expensive. And anyway, I won't go into all that, but I want to insist that the iconic building has this hidden, implicit coding relating to nature and the cosmos. So in my written work, I've been talking about that, and in my written and design work, been emphasizing our shift in culture from a Christian culture, where, as you see in this moralized French Bible of the 13th century, God is a young architect, based on Plato's metaphor, God, the great architect of all things, in the Timaeus, he talks about that metaphor. God as an architect is laying out the universe with a pair of architectural instruments. He's holding the universe in one hand. He's giving it order, beauty, harmony. You can see earth, air, water, and fire there. You can see fractal architecture. And he's stepping out of the frame of the painting to show his omnipotence and his omniscience. And you can see his beard. He's a man of, let's say, maturity. Very much a male architect, designer, designing a purposeful, ordered, beautiful, mixed universe. Today, of course, if you see the other view there, it's a different kind of universe. Instead of genesis, it's cosmogenesis, and it's brought to us by scientists, among others, as well as philosophers and artists. So in my own work, The Garden of Cosmic Speculation, and later work of the last 10 years, I've been speculating with scientists and philosophers and others. Here's Jim Watson, who I worked with on many works at his own institute in Long Island, but here's the opening of a DNA sculpture at the place where he was a student at Cambridge University and worked along with Crick and others to decode this unit of life, this atom of life, if you like. So in the iconic building and in my own work, I'm looking for icons which are eternal, indubitable, creative, but constrained by the laws of nature, the laws of the cosmos, the laws of the universe, on the one hand, but open to interpretation and different visual metaphors. So I think a public language of architecture and icons is possible if it zigzags in and out of enigmatic and paranoid meanings. And in the Garden of Cosmic Speculation, you can see many parts of maybe 35 or 40 parts of this garden. I won't take you through the garden, but it has, each part of it has one insight from science, such as black hole terrace, such as the universe as a whole, the DNA garden, and so on. Each of these, the 30 or 40 areas, is conceived with scientists and others in a language which criticizes, I must insist on that, criticizes the metaphor of science at the same time that it accepts many of the underlying ideas. The language that the basic metaphor I've used here is the language of waves, because waveforms, we know that everything in the universe is a wave and a particle, and so this landscape of waves I tried to bring out in many different parts as the underlying metaphor, not only waves of planting, but water waves and you'll see electronic waves. One of the entrances is over this terrace, the fractal terrace, which you see on your left has this old steading, a barn, which is based on vernacular language related to the classical. And the classical, as Plato said, is made out of the underlying laws of nature are made out of perfect solids, such as the regular solids, the sphere, the cube, and so forth. So as the fractal terrace goes from left to right, you see the building itself come down in gray and white and turn into rectangles, and the rectangles morph into squares, the squares turn into rhomboids, the rhomboids turn into fractals, the fractals grow into the ground and then come out, as you'll see in a second, as teeth. And the words themselves metamorphose, the letters metamorphose as you read from left to right. So this terrace, which is an entryway into the garden looking at DNA double helix, shows the two basic languages of nature, the geometric perfect solids, which resemble the sun and spherical, perfect geometries, which Plato said underlie all of nature, and what Benoit Mandelbrot and later philosophers of nature said is the geometry of most of nature. That is, 80% is fractal, trees and growing elements and galaxies and so on. So you see the two views of nature's languages surrounding the entrance to the curving as you enter one part of the garden. I jump to just one other part, which develops the underlying languages of the smallest, that is, the ultimate particles. This is by a little burn, they call it there, but it's a little stream or brook. You can see the languages which come from the linear accelerator, that is, these measurements of what happens in an explosion in a linear accelerator. And if you think about it, the quarks and all those ultimate particles, they, like the laws of nature, they underlie all of growing nature. In other words, electricity, electromagnetism, gravity, etc., strong and weak force, are the underlying cosmic code which leads to the possibilities of the nature that grows upon it. So I thought in a garden, what could be better than to reflect these beautiful languages which are shown in these photographs of these explosion events, really collision events between particle and antiparticle. Beautiful language, and you see in this picture to the right that if you take a three-dimensional explosion and you reflect it in the water, then you can see the photograph that was taken, which revealed the quark as an underlying language. And this was developed through many linear accelerators, but above all at ATLAS in CERN. And I show you, you could see the size of a person there. The size of this circular measurement instrument through which these protons and antiprotons travel at the speed of light and then hit each other, and then in the collisions, coming out through all of these circular forms, these curves are measured, and then they tell you with great difficulty, it takes them about a month and a half to decode what they're seeing, they tell you what the kind of a particle is. Well, this is the CERN is the center of this endeavor, and it started about the same time as UCSD. It's now one of the last great Enlightenment projects to decode these collisions and find out how the universe started. And as you probably know, most scientists think we can look back through these methods to the first microsecond. And what I show in this image is the explosion above, and then that photograph, which confirmed the that indeed these quarks, you could infer these quarks behind the protons. And so you see, like the art, it is very enigmatic, it's very inferential, and it's based on multiple interpretations and disagreements and criticism. I showed in the same, this is called the quark walk. In the quark walk, there's a seat, and you see the explosion coming from the left, the collision, and then you see the standard model coming out of that. There is the standard model, which we've spent something like $55 billion proving. It's one of the most greatly proved ideas in nature, of ultimate nature. The only problem is we can't find the Higgs boson. This is the one missing element, but we found all the others. And in that sense, it's extraordinary intellectual achievement because we found it when we're looking for it. You know, the theory of the standard model says if you keep looking there, you will find it. And each time that we've looked and spent another $5 billion, we've ended up finding it. A lot of them found here in California, a lot of them found in Switzerland, where CERN is. But no one can find the Higgs boson, and no one can find Mr. Higgs himself. He's a very modest scientist. But he lives 60 miles north of this. And I managed to find him. He came, and he's looking down at the missing Higgs boson, which, if we find it, will complete the standard model. But we may not find it. And this is really kind of interesting, because if we don't find it at all, then the standard model breaks up. And that's why in this symbolic rendition of the standard model, I show moss growing between the parts of it, and it's kind of in collapse because, you know, it's just difficult to find. The scientists are wonderful. They say, well, if we find it, it confirms it. If we don't find it, it's even better because we'll have to have a new theory. So they take a rather ironic view of ultimate things. In any case, because of this work, I was asked to work at CERN, and it has grown in the last 50 years, and it's overgrown. It's become almost a mess of success, a suburbia of where one thing was added to another, and it grew like Topsy, and there was no coherence. Unlike UCSD, there were no series of master plans that had a narrative and coherence. And so I was asked to come in and give them a critique of how they were growing. And you can see the center of CERN in this globe, which is the kind of heart of the area. Other than this area, though, they're running out of room. And their globe, which was placed there in about 2003, is really also surrounded by cars and traffic and a kind of macadam or asphalt context. So they're, in a way, by not having a plan and not having a critical view, they've managed to pollute their own situation. So I put forward a landscape strategy of a green oasis and talked about how they had to have both a program of surrounding this public realm and also an iconic program to go with it. Because one of the things about CERN is it has great difficulty in communicating to the public what it's doing and what its message is and the meaning of its message. So the Green Oasis was developed in certain ways, in sketches and so forth, to be a kind of defensible area with edges. And I showed them, you know, this plan, which fascinated them for understandable reasons, and said, in a way, you know, you have become the Vatican of the Enlightenment, and your narrative should be as strongly put as it was developed by Sixtus V and the popes and the architects in Rome. Of course, the architects who worked on this included Bramante, who designed the original plan, Michelangelo, who added to it, Moderna, who rather made a mess of the front, and a series of other great architects, above all, including Bernini, who used the metaphor of a landscape metaphor of the arms of the building, as it were, embracing the people, the citizens and pilgrims who would come from all over Christendom to meet at this center of the earth pole, as it were. So I presented this to CERN, and they kept saying to me, can we go back to that slide of the Vatican? They became interested in their into this metaphor. But if you looked at their iconographic program as it existed, this is what they put outside the globe. It says CERN, so it tells you what it is, CERN, and it says you should love dipoles, and how many people love dipoles. And they say it's a superconductor, and it's the Large Hadron Collider, LHC. So their symbolic program, their icons, were not developed. They were based, really, on just putting a magnet, which accelerates the protons and antiprotons, outside, painting it blue and white. And so it seems to me that it really is as important to talk about the iconology behind it, iconic buildings, and to come up with one that is somewhat indisputable. So I had recourse to what's called the cosmic Ouroboros. Ouroboros is a snake eating its tail, sign of infinity in 1600 BC in Egypt, a sign of continuity. And you see, in this case, this is, by the way, I think the version created by scientists and philosophers in Southern California, who drew this metaphor of Midgard, Midgard being the place that we can see and inhabit. If you look at that part of the diagram, you see the ant to the left of Midgard, people next to the ant, mountain, the earth, and the sun. That's what we and our physics and metaphysics has grown up with. And then you see to the right, as the sizes get bigger, you see solar systems and then galaxies, superclusters, and so forth, until you get to the size of the universe as a whole. If you go the other way, you see DNA, the atom, the W and Z particle, and then smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller. So what was really interesting about this diagram is that many scientists believe in it. It shows the smallest things in the universe to the biggest, the universe itself, and CERN is working on this program itself because it's accelerating protons and antiprotons, hadrons, at each other, and then through the collisions, through the very small debris, analyzing how the universe originated, or when it originated, or what theories might explain its origination. So from the very small to the very big is a perfect kind of public symbolism and diagram for an iconography. And the only problem, well, there are several problems with it, but one of the obvious ones was, a snake eating its tail is not really how we understand the universe anymore. And what CERN is doing, really, is asking the question with the very small of the very big. So the question became the icon, the iconology, part of the iconology of CERN. And it allowed, but the scale allowed me to locate different icons on it. So the green oasis then became a plan, and it was filled out with a different kind of sculptural programs which focus on this question and anti-question, these landforms which protect it. And working with architects on this site, it's been developed with an iconography of collisions for awnings and so forth. And you can see more up-to-date icons of those collisions, which are really their public symbolism. To the right, you can see the collisions coming out in different lengths, which are measured by different instruments further and further away. So that led, the CERN collisions led with this these Corbusier spectacles to an iconology. And if one thinks of the eye and you look at the eye closely, you'll see it has these measuring instruments of structure. As a metaphor, it's therefore kind of relevant, I think, for the eye of the universe and what they're doing at CERN. So, in effect, I gave an iconology and formal system to protect this green heart, and it's incorporated in the elements and the future sculpture. Well, let me shift gears now and develop another line of argument. If you think of UCSD as a developing program, then it relates very closely to ideas of modernism, which came in the 40s and 50s from a lot of people, but above all from Le Corbusier and his famous plan for the reconstruction of a city which had been destroyed in the war, Saint-Dié. This is the Saint-Dié plan you see. It has housing to the left in these zigzag apartments, and it has the heart of the center to the right side. And what it shows, basically, is in black, it shows the plan of the buildings, and in white, the space around it. And you can see immediately one of the problems of modern planning, which under postmodernism and other theories of urbanism was criticized again and again and again. That is to say, it doesn't have the kind of positive figural void or shapes that traditional cities have. Each of these monuments in the park, city in the park, as Le Corbusier called it, can be seen in 360 degrees all the way around it, and it stands out as standalone buildings of sculpture in a green background. The city in the park really was like a Henry Moore sculpture placed in an idyllic landscape. In other words, for those who disliked this kind of city planning, it was a form of suburbanization. And to a certain extent, it became the way of thinking about city development, at least in modern architecture, and then with developers, it became a way of handling these bigger and bigger and bigger commissions of 20 million, 40 million, 60 million, 100 million. Because you can control them and design them as packages which are separate. For those who disliked it, it became not only a standalone building, but the architecture of the lonesome cowboy. In any case, on one level, I think you can see that the early development of UCSD through the Alexander Plan and others was a form of modern planning and suburban planning. In other words, they're big chunks put in an idyllic landscape. But then in the next plans, in 1966 and later, a kind of dialectic started, which is very interesting. You probably know a lot about that dialectic, but it's one of the things I think in a future plan ought to be made explicit. That is the the slow growth of oppositional thinking through criticism and through changing the code. So Alexander's linear, what was called the Champs-Élysées, which could be considered both a modern layout and a classical one, was criticized by Mosher, an architect involved, and the campus axis was partly shifted to the right with a new focus on the Geisel Library, which you see in this campus building, buildings of 2010. You can just look at that diagram and compare it to Sandia and see that as chunks, large, big chunks of the environment being built, it is rather like Le Corbusier's plan. In other words, it's a lot of open space and nature around big buildings. And even the build-out plan of the future, which is infilling to some extent and densifying for sure, is still carries forward that slightly suburban feel and modernist planning. So thinking about that through the lens of a critique, then the Noli plan of the 1750s and its Rome version here by the architect Noli shows in a clearly understandable language of black and white the dialectical nature of public space versus monuments, which are usually around the public space, and private space, which is usually put in a background fabric. So the Noli plan became a method of thinking about an oppositional urbanism based on difference between public and private, space, between foreground and background, between vernacular and classical, between monument and the support of the monument. And it's that which was turned into what I'm calling in this talk contextual counterpoint. That is a contextualism not like the one advocated by Prince Charles and others, which reflects and is in keeping completely with the past, but one which is like counterpoint in music, which contrasts with in taking the themes and developing them in always creative ways. And I think the master of this was really James Stirling. I show you one of his best buildings, the plan for the Stuttgart New Staatsgalerie, this U-shaped new building, which was next to the old building to the left, another U-shaped classical plan based on the work of Schinkel and other neoclassicists in Germany. Well, Stirling, the English architect, won this in a competition with his transformation of this previous grammar, and he makes many comments on the past with these sculptural forms, which he designed all the way through as a walk or architectural promenade, or as he phrased it, you know, with a worm's eye view and a bird's eye view, as a continuous dramatic unfolding of sculpture in space, in such a way that it takes the people who live in this area, just up the hill, it takes them through the museum, the new museum, but it doesn't make them go into the museum. So there's a very interesting dialectic and counterpoint between all of those oppositions I've mentioned in the Noli plan, public and private and so on, and the context that exists on the site. I'll show you a recent photograph I took about 6 months ago of the area going up the hill. It's high-speed traffic to the left, and the grain of the existing context inflecting in all sorts of ways. There's a vernacular style. There's five different styles used in this building, some of them classical, some of them explicit, some of them vernacular, some of them modern. Stuttgart was the great modern center in 1929 when the modernists built their housing. Here you see the public area. In fact, you see Jim Stirling himself. I was there with him photographing the building. He's the big Jim in the foreground there in black photographing it. And you can see a curious, one of the languages he uses was the high-tech, colorful high-tech of red and blue and pink as the places of accent to take people through. This is very strange to use symbolically what was a technical language. He uses it for lighting, for balustrades, and he contrasts that. The counterpoint is with an undulating hyperbolic form, you see, where you enter, and then a canopy in oranges and blues. Other than that, there's a Romanesque stilted arches, there's the banded classical architecture, very heavy Egyptian coved moldings, and a kind of Schinkelesque classicism of the original building. So five styles, five different voices, yet a coherent whole, continuity in something that nestles into the context. When he had to aerate the parking garage, they changed the program, so he knocked out the wall and aerated it with this ruin. So there's a lot of humor in this counterpoint, and yet a lot of serious work. It was one of his few popular buildings on a mass level, and there you see him surrounded by the youth in their day glow contemporary costumes just like the high tech. So it's really an interesting example of multiple coding, many voice discourse. In his later work, or just a little bit later, this is the work where his exhibition is now on. It's come from Yale to London. It's in his addition to the Tate Gallery. And you can see the second part of this contextual counterpoint, what I call the chameleon building, which takes on the coloration and the aspects of the buildings just adjacent to it. So since it's next to this rather banal but existing brick 19th century pastiche, he takes the corner of the building, erodes it, puts his green garden building there, and then changes the brick to stucco. Then for the formal entrance, he turns it again to a classical void, which is very similar to the kind of neoclassicism of the Tate, and then changes it again as it goes around the corner. When it's in back, it's a completely industrial aesthetic. You can just see there as the building goes behind the brick building and turns into industrial brick. So the chameleon, as a strategy, is an interesting, well-developed move in contextual counterpoint in the last 20 years. And if you think of UCSD as having to face infill as a major strategy, then the question is, how do you infill? Well, you have to deal with the existing styles. You have to do a study of those styles. You really have to be sympathetic with them, and you have to enjoy the game. So I think an important part of what I'm saying is, if that is the middle, if you're in the middle of the end game or the beginning of the middle of the end game, then it's important that you formulate these methods and strategies that already have been highly developed, actually. In Venturi, we're wonderful to be in a Venturi example of contextual counterpoint here. I didn't know about it till this afternoon. And I show you another example of the chameleon building. Here he takes up the existing building to his right in the National Gallery. He plays it with a ghost pilaster. Then he opens it with this big void because that's where the bus traffic stops and mass tourists come running in. And then as the building goes around the corner, it relates to the building opposite in its window moldings. And then when it gets in back, like Jim Sterling's, it turns into a very utilitarian architecture. So you can say that the chameleon buildings are now a well-developed strategy, and we, and certainly Venturi and Sterling, enjoy them. I wanted to show you this recently completed Hotel Fouquet in the 8th arrondissement in Paris, which is an extraordinary building by Edouard François, a man who does a lot of green buildings with a great humor and zest. But in this building, it was mandated, because it's a very conservative part of Paris, where everything has to be in keeping with the Haussmann grain of the building. What he actually did is, like Rachel Whiteread, he made casts of the building in concrete, in three different kinds of concrete. And then, because the client demanded it, he jammed a 13-story building in a 5-story morphology. But like a good postmodernist, he told you what he was doing. If you look closely at this, you can see how amusingly real it is. 8 stories are above ground, 5 are below ground. You could say it's a horrible commission. How can you, accept a client who demands such a high volume use? Well, it is, of course, a part of our late capitalist time that you have to do, or you don't have to do these things. You can refuse them, but if you do accept them, and you accept the taste of the surrounding people, that is to say, if you're a Democrat and you accept that other people's tastes are valid, you can't have a single taste for everybody, then it gets you into this complicated area of pastiching with integrity, which is what he's done here. If you look at the top of the building, you see how these television set windows for hotels, which are mandated by hotels, big horizontal, picture window, modernist windows, are juxtaposed and even eat into the œil de bœuf at the top, or cut across the moldings, or eat into the string courses between floors, because that's the reality. He wants to show you the complexity and contradiction and make a humorous, sensuous art out of it. It's a very, very, very interesting concrete building with, this mixture of steel and detailing, which is just edible. That jumped on before I touched it, but it shows him. He even puts his face, like Charles Moore put his face in one of his buildings. He cast his face as an 18th century person. Now, this brings us to the time city. If time is the architect, as Victor Hugo said, then, look at the German cities that the Americans, the British, bombed in Berlin and Munich. They've worked out over the last 50 years an amazing strategy of paraphrase, of patching, of renewing, and doing all of that together in a multiple style. So this was a man named Dolgas putting together the big Alte Pinakothek in Munich, in the Museum Island. And you can see how he mixes his new construction with the old existing structure that remained, and whitewashes over the mixture to pull it all together. Well, that strategy has been taken to the next step by David Chipperfield, now Sir David, who has won all the prizes, just won the Mies van der Rohe Prize 2 weeks ago for this building. And the Egyptian, you see the Egyptian room of the Neues Museum in Berlin, which was heavily bombed, and in the 19th century, when the building was built, it was really itself a pastiche. When it was bombed, it wasn't repaired until very recently. It took Chipperfield a long time to repair it. But it's interesting, the repair, especially in the Egyptian part, is better than the original, because he's put it together with all of these different sympathetic masonry parts. And it manages, rather like the Stirling building, to speak on many different levels. So the two architectural tastes of Britain, which are always fighting, that is to say, Lord Rogers versus Prince Charles, have, sat down together and agreed that this building is a magnificent one. So one of the points I'm trying to make in the Time City, if you look on time, ruins, accretions, and infill as an art, as these examples show, then you can get a new architecture of integrity through talking to the different parts of a city. And I think it's Herzog and de Meuron who've taken this maybe to the extreme with their building for La Caixa Forum in Madrid, working with the vertical garden designer Patrick Blanc from Paris. They've created a mixture of a green wall, a putting together of the context, the ancient context of Madrid, adding to it a museum on the inside using an old 19th century industrial electric building, which had to be the facade, which had to be kept because it was mandated in brick. And they've punched out certain windows, rather like Edouard Francois, asymmetrical to the old grammar. And above that, they've used a kind of heavy cast iron to mirror in a ghost-like way the existing fabric, rather like Venturi does with his ghost buildings. So it's a very complex building, which is raised off the ground, opening up the ground to people who are going to these different squares, using a reflective style, a fractal style for that. So again, if you look at this view of the undercroft and you see the walk up through the building in the lower photographs, you can see how high-tech and other styles are mixed. Until you get to the top, where you look out through the restaurant ornament, and it's fractal ornament, you look on Patrick Blanc's green wall on the outside. So in a way, this time building celebrates the walk through a museum through complexity, through different tastes, and ends with a celebration of nature and the city. That is to say, there's some narrative behind this complexity. It's certainly very humorous, very enjoyable, and sensuous, all of that together. Now, to come back to UCSD and its existing context, well, of course, being in this wonderful microclimate and cosmic environment where the Pacific meets the landmass of America, this between order coming out of chaos, as it were, this very exciting, dynamic place, you can say that the first moves have understood, the first moves of Gill and others have understood completely the nature of relating to that cosmic background. So the earliest views of 1910 and so, showing the first Scripps building and then this very curious tower right next to it, which fell down later. All of that set against a kind of desert, or at least semi-arid climate, celebrating both the, by putting it in that juxtaposition to nature and celebrating culture at the same time. So that cosmic code, I would argue, has been here and has been incorporated in different kinds of architecture, in an architecture which has been often opposed to the modernism of concrete, that is to say, the wooden architecture of redwood and Frank Lloyd Wright's organic architecture. That's obviously a fundamental dialectical set of languages on this campus. And I show you the Munk Laboratory of 1963, looking one way on the right to the old pier and to the left back to nature. A nature which now, under the inflection of the Colorado River and other waters that are brought here, has suddenly turned from semi-arid to amazingly Edenic in its lushness. I think the early postmodern version of this is in Liu Kahn's heroic designs for Salk, which definitely focus on the setting sun, on the water with this rill that goes down, a very slender rill, actually suggested by Barragan, by Tucon, but built by Kahn. This amazing way you take in the horizon, the cosmic horizon, the setting sun, and orienting each individual scientist's private study towards that, towards the view into the wind and so on, and yet building those private studies out of a smaller textured wood, while behind them the bigger laboratories exist. So I would argue this is one of the first, if not the first, of the cosmic postmodern buildings which is oriented to nature in such a powerful way, an iconic building. As indeed, Geisel is an obvious iconic building. When it was in the dialectic of argument of UCSD, it was part of the criticism of the Alexander plan was put forward by Mosher, the architect, who said, the Alexander plan is too formal, it's too controlling, it's too ordered, the students won't like it, it's too fascist, it's Mussolini, it's Hitler. He made those comments. And this shift in language and planning was towards a more organic architecture of Quincy Jones, who did some of the master planning, and Pereira's own version, if you like, of Wright. If you consider Wright's cantilevered work as one of the inspirations for this. I show it in its earlier stages. It became, of course, as you know, the logo for UCSD, and it remains an obvious iconic building. If you analyze it as such, it's, of course, seen as a spaceship, as an alien object that's landed on the site. It's slightly paranoid in this radioactive sunset you see behind it. It's those who criticized it called it an inverted pyramid, upside down. It's a crystal from some points of view, echelons. And I found out today it's also a metaphor which, once you know it, you begin to see it as. It's a tree with its branches and trunk of knowledge. So those mixed metaphors obviously have accrued around it, and it's become a loved, much loved symbol, starting off maybe with a different feeling for some people at least. Well, also, and this I think is a very interesting lesson, it's been mediated by this lush nature that has, from this view up Peter Walker's Avenue, has taken over this disjunction between the building and the rest of the campus, so that Mother Nature has been very forgiving, and I think is in a lot in UCSD. With, as Charles Moore said, in a way, the landscape architects of Southern California are more daring than the architects, but much less known. This is Moore's remark, and it seems to me that landscape architects have been a great boon to not only this campus but a lot of the University of California campuses. And also the artist, Alexis Smith, who interpreted, because when the underground part of this building was created, they had a lot of spoil, and she created, along with landscape architects, this mound. And to get down the mound, obviously, she was inspired by the zigzag pathway, which is functionally helpful. And she turned that into the metaphor of a snake. So the snake path became her symbolic program, iconographic program. And she, interestingly, she tilts the snake to the left of the building as you come to the top, so that the snake veers off towards the entrance of the underground part. And then as you snake down and the tail, you begin to understand that one of the programs she's using is the tree of knowledge and the notion that that knowledge, from a Christian point of view, is something that one should not be so bold as to pursue. And she has quotes from various poems and the Milton's Paradise Lost. So this becomes a more complex metaphor as you begin to sit in it and read it and experience this Edenic hill that the landscape architects have created. And so as her metaphor goes on, it goes across the long open area, and it ends in another metaphor, which is Paradise Regained. The only sadness about this is when you visit Paradise Regained, it's much less well-planted than Paradise Lost. Anyway, as you probably know, Christians became upset about this, and they came to the top of the snake, and they said many prayers in order to fight off the interpretation of evil, which they felt was built into this program. I was today there, and there were also some Christians, very strong Christians, making a demonstration outside the front. So this is an interesting reinterpretation of Alexis Smith's program, because it's not at all clear that she had that critique in mind, although it's a possible way of interpreting it. But I again bring up the point that it's the multiple interpretations which really matter in a campus coming to maturity. And it seems to me the art is absolutely essential, as much as nature, in contextualizing this background. But of course, it's also the master plans, which have been, I think, since the 1989 master plan, very intelligent developments of a coherent program which has been looked after by the successive leaders and campus architects. So they've developed five basic points. Of course, above all, the park, the neighborhood plans. You see the something like 15 neighborhoods picked out here in different colors. The university center, trying to urbanize the center. The academic corridors to connect up things, and the connections themselves in pedestrian in yellow and vehicular in red. So there has been an incredibly intelligent development of these different strategies and styles, an open space system, a hierarchy of open space, in two different sorts of styles, a high style landscaping and a rustic style landscaping. And as I've mentioned, the all-important Stewart collection, overseen by Mary Beebe, which many people think is the most interesting example of public art in America, the most interesting public art program. An extraordinary thing for a university campus to create over so many years. A great asset, and something which I think shows another aspect of this coming to maturity of UCSD. You obviously all know the story, again, a Christian story of what happened to this when they were developing the Price Center, and they cut down many of the eucalyptus trees of the grove. They made the mistake when they cut them down not to get rid of the whole evidence, and the students immediately had a counterattack and put white crosses on all the, you know, the living dead. And it became written in then to the master plan that these groves had to be considered something not to be disturbed or cut down at night or cut down by architects and others who want to develop the site. So important, again, if you think back to the time as the builder, the cosmos and the context are the architects. The metaphor of my talk. So many strategies are used. Densifying. Is densifying really urbanism? Not. I don't think it quite is, because of the size of the chunks and the space between the buildings isn't embraced as in contextual counterpoint. But, I mean, if you look at the center of the campus now, the urban center, it's not quite the mixture of voices and multiple meanings that I've been talking about. This is just glass and concrete, a lot of it. At the same time, there's this other very deep commitment to science and nature, the study of nature, the study of the universe, which starts off with Scripps and culminates in all of these awards and commitments to sustainability, which you obviously know a great deal about, and which is evident in obviously in solar collectors, but in so many other ways, including the energy park, which is under construction in the east part of campus. So already I would argue there is a emergent symbolic program created by the past, by the art, and by this new found focus on the energy problem and sustainability. You have this in your past, and it's clearly a great strength, a great possibility if it's consciously brought to the to the strategy of the next set of plans. And I think with a building such as the Powell Structural Engineering Lab, the work of Bruce Nauman is really, in its way, a kind of contemporary version of a frieze, like might have been done in the Parthenon, with cosmic oppositions between negative vices such as lust and sloth in italics, going against upright and true virtues in other colors. So Nauman really, in one of, I think, his greatest works, has celebrated these, if you like, eternal passions and oppositions in the human, and let us say in the non-human condition. So I want to end with several ideas. First of all, the notion of a critical modernism, which faces up to problems which are extremely difficult. It, above all, modernist problems themselves, problems of success. In this cover of the book on critical modernism, I show unzipping the modern architecture and its several categories. In the most famous diagram of modern art put forward in the 30s for the Museum of Modern Art, you can see all lines ending in modern architecture, and it's clearly an oversimplification of history in both modernism and today. So I unzip that in the book critically, but really wanted to also critique some of the underlying metaphors that some scientists have put forward about the cosmos, such as the Big Bang. It wasn't big, it wasn't bang, no one heard it, it was smaller than the quark. All of these metaphors, selfish gene, another one. And on the other hand, you can see in the Languages of Architecture, Corbusier in the top row, or Foster's Gherkin or Pickle in the mid row, you can see that there is a cosmic architecture emerging, and architects and artists are somewhat public in their handling of this language. But an artist who I particularly admire, whose this work I don't admire, is the Japanese-American who worked and who ended up having his studio in Brooklyn. And he created wonderful enigmas. Noguchi created these enigmas in the background in his garden of the stones. It's called the Enigma of the Fifth Stone in the background. You walk around it and you keep trying to find the fifth stone. But in the foreground, he created a piece of broken granite called the Big Bang. And this seems to me an unconvincing piece of art and a rather trivial metaphor, both because the Big Bang is itself a trivial metaphor, but also because his treatment of it is simply to break a stone into five parts and present it as a one-liner. So I think one has to be critical and open of artists and architects one loves when they, or scientists one loves, when their metaphors themselves are questionable. And in my own work, I work with scientists, here's the universe cascade, to try to bring forward new metaphors, such as the jumping universe, to our visual understanding. But I have to say, of course, that the iconic building has its victims, great victims, such as, in this case, this is Zaha Hadid's design for the concert halls in Abu Dhabi, in the most built-up part of this new area. The Sandiyat Island is an $18 billion project for getting the icons of the five great international architects to come and recreate the Louvre and other museums in its as its centerpieces. Well, in the area where with one of the hottest climates in the world, Zaha has designed a glass building, which, you know, on any level of sustainability is completely mad. And as a, you know, as a metaphor, it's, well, like all a lot of her very seductive undulating buildings is interesting, but it seems to me it reveals the one of the reasons people hate iconic buildings. It's inappropriate, too expensive, and likely to be a catastrophe. So, you know, and Zaha is a very close friend of mine, and I've commissioned buildings for her. So I'm making the point that in the Middle East, if you just think what's happening in the Middle East, it's a very interesting kind of situation when the Arab Spring is happening. Maybe it will be a catastrophe, who knows? But it is happening, and one has to keep one's eyes open. And one of the curious things that is happening is that the urbanism is becoming very oriented in certain cases towards the sustainability, which is based on both vernacular and traditional Arab and Muslim architecture, desert architecture, walled architecture, contextual architecture, architecture which has, you know, very convivial spaces in it and which is mixed in style. So I'll just show you one new city. And it's interesting that if you look at these iconic architects who are building in the Middle East on the oil road to China, you see one of the controversies of about 2 years ago when, if you look very closely at those designs in the middle of this picture, you see Kuhlhaus and Foster clash over similar, quote, designs. And then the subtitle says, no plagiarism, but we were first, says Ram, as Fosters deny any real likeness between the schemes. And so you see the two schemes below, and, you know, Kuhlhaus is competing against Foster. He's been doing this for the last 10 years. And with iconic buildings, you know, you can say some of them are great and some of them are catastrophic. But what is really interesting, too, is that they're competing over sustainability and over densification, over all of those aspects I've been trying to bring out in this talk. And that's interesting, isn't it? And it's interesting that it's occurring in the Middle East, where this is becoming an archetype. And so, excuse me, one of the things that's created this spring is, of course, Al Jazeera's, which comes out of Doha, which, you know, is based on all of the BBC announcers went out to Doha, were hired as a whole, and now they give you the most interesting news, much better than the BBC. And that has inspired many of these movements in these different Arab countries. It's interesting that the urbanism proposed for Doha, I'm showing you, is done by a modernist, and two modernists have done this postmodern urbanism with, you know, with a kind of new technologies and new systems of communication, which are, to a certain extent, green. And they've located these in the center of the city, a very convivial pedestrian area with closed streets as well as through streets. So you can never tell. I mean, one of the reasons I'm ending with them is that you can never tell where the most interesting things that have come from and how they're going to come in a global situation. I think it's very interesting that that is the case with some of this work, some of this urban work. So even if one is alienated by the icons, the iconic buildings, there's a positive competition. I want to conclude with a summary of some of the points I've been talking about. First of all, under late capitalism, When building parcels vary from $20 to $180 million, as they do on campus. But urbanism demands you build smaller chunks, in-between spaces, contextual counterpart. You must have a new administrative model, a new method of funding, one that can commission and pay for the intermediate buildings, the infill that'll occur, and enjoy the end game and not feel it is a burden. Because clearly, out of modernism, that modernists do feel it's a burden if they're not doing the attention-grabbing buildings. It's a question of enjoying this game and the hybrid styles and the dialectic and the many voices. Secondly, it would help if you carried out a stylistic inventory of your buildings, showing the truer history and dialectic that has occurred since the Native American Indians and in the last 50 years on campus, not just modernism and late modernism, but maybe 20 or so extant styles and metaphysics. Let's make an enjoyment of the different metaphysics, the different points of view. If you put the Stuart Collection on the planning map and made the art and symbolism more important in the collective psyche, gave it the significance that many people around the world find it deserves, then the iconography might partly grow out of this. Instead of being sometimes a piety of naming buildings after they have been built, the mirror buildings, I think, is a classic case where one was named a mountain, another one was named a sea, and another one was given, an ecological name. And if you look at them, they have absolutely no relationship to those symbols that were later put on them. Finally, I believe you have many of the components of a synthesis already existing. The natural resources, the great coastline, the greatest climate, the eucalyptus grove, the energy program, the new energy park. You could pull it all together with a conscious cosmic symbolism, and you probably guessed I would say this, but the question is, why not, if you have all of this, as it were, in your own bank? As at CERN, I believe you need a new formal program of urbanism and a coherent iconography based at once on pluralism and a unifying symbolic program based on the universe. I have a strong feeling that you already have these ideas underway, and it is a question of bringing them to greater consciousness and instituting a new plan that continues to build on that very interesting plan of 1989. Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.